From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The president spent much of last night tweeting book recommendations, mostly from Fox News personalities. Maybe he should get a copy of All the President's Men. Trump is known as Individual One in Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's investigation. On Thursday, Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty to lying to Congress about Trump's talks with the Russians over a possible development. Trump had some words to say about that, too.
He's a weak person, and what he's trying to do is get a reduced sentence. So he's lying about a project that everybody knew about.
Meanwhile, some signs of independence from the Republican-led U.S. Senate, which rebuked the Trump administration over its support for Saudi attacks on Yemen. Utah Senator Michael Lee, a Republican, says the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi has caused people to wonder this.
Why we should so blindly, so willingly enter into an alliance with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to fight the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen.
Join us for a conversation about all this and much more. Have any of the Mueller disclosures changed your mind in either direction? If you support the president, what would convince you a line had been irreparably crossed? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Boston is Kimberly Atkins, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Herald. Kim, great to have you back.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Kathy Gilsonen, senior editor at The Atlantic. She oversees the global section. Kathy, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Kim, and Kathy.
Well, I think we're going to spend some real time on the Mueller investigation and what we've learned this week. But let us start first with what's happening right now at the G20 down in South America. Kathy, why don't you start us off? The president had some things on his agenda. What's he focusing on first?
Well, he has arrived. He's it seems that he's a little bit focused, actually, on the Mueller investigation, too, right, since he's been spending time tweeting about this witch hunt. But he's got a lot of things on his agenda. He signed this new NAFTA overhaul, what he bills as a NAFTA overhaul with the Canadians. And so that now has to be ratified by all three countries. But this has been, you know, he portrays this as a huge win for himself. This was a major campaign promise that he made. And the new deal does include some things like new requirements for automotive components to be made in North America and wage protections for workers. So he will be claiming that as a victory. And the other big thing on his agenda.
Let me just let people hear what he had to say this morning at the G20 summit. He was stood side by side with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. They're signing the trade deal. It is, as you say, going to replace NAFTA. Here's what President Trump says about why this will be such a huge success for the U.S. economy.
In the United States, the new trade pact will support high-paying manufacturing jobs and promote greater access for American exports across the range of sectors, including our farming, manufacturing, and service industries.
So, Kathy, you know, I noted that the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called this the new NAFTA. The president has his own fancy terms for it. How significant a deal is this?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I think that every party is interested in portraying this as a win, right? And so from Canada's perspective, they were perfectly happy with the old NAFTA. And so it's in their interest to portray this as, you know, look, this is just some tweaks around the margins. We're saving this thing that's been really great for the Canadian economy. On the other hand, you know, from the Trump administration's perspective, they've been railing against NAFTA since before Trump was even considering running for president. So it's in his interest to rename it the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the USMCA. So the extent to which this is a tweak at the margins versus a total overhaul of the entire North American economic trading system is up for debate, depending on who is talking about it.
Kimberly Atkins, there were questions about who the president would meet down there and what you know, other agenda he would have. How have his plans changed in the last few days?
Yeah. So initially there was on his schedule a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, something that is always highly anticipated whenever the president is scheduled to meet with him. He's met with him several times in the course of his presidency over the last couple of years. But then suddenly those plans changed, and it coincidentally happened right after Michael Cohen, his personal attorney, entered a plea agreement agreement, which sheds some light into how people within the campaign or within President Trump's circle may have been reaching out to Russian officials and to WikiLeaks in the months leading up to the election. And given those optics, there was a cancellation of that meeting. Now, the president and the White House officially said it's because of Russia's actions in seizing some naval vessels of the Ukraine, and that Ukraine-Russia standoff. But that happened nearly a week ago, and the White House hadn't been very concerned about that until he got on the plane heading to Argentina.
Even despite the Ukrainians saying, hey, we think we want NATO to send some vessels in.
Correct.
Here. We want some real response here in the Crimea.
Correct. Before he took off, President Trump told reporters that he was planning on meeting with Putin still. And after he took off, very quickly, that meeting was scuttled.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, just to draw on your expertise a little bit, how serious do you think that tension is between Russia and Ukraine right now? And what implications does it have for countries beyond them?
I think it's very serious, and I think it's the first, you know, since the Russian annexation of the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea back a couple years ago, this is the first major direct confrontation between those two countries' militaries. And you're already seeing the Ukrainians declaring martial law, right? So the Ukrainians themselves are taking this very seriously. And it also raises questions, you know, Ukraine's declaration of martial law raises questions about the quality of democracy in that country and the extent to which Russian aggression has been able to undermine the internal coherence of this country that has really been trying to assert its independence from Russia ever since the end of the Cold War. And so, and before, right, but has successfully been doing it since the Soviet Union fell. So I think it's very serious, and it's, you know, tensions have been high there for a long time, and there's been an ongoing war in Ukraine that's killed 10,000 people while people have been turning away. So I don't think it's going to I don't think the tensions are going to lessen anytime soon.
You know, there are, concerns about things happening all over the world. And yet it seems to me at times it's like this administration has this Brady Bunch dynamic where it's like Marcia, Russia, Russia, Russia. You have to get back to it, you know. Jack Beatty, I want to turn a little bit to the question of Russia. But the question now, thinking about this legal investigation, this criminal investigation, we have two, let's be clear about this, two felons returning to court. That is the president's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, now pleading in a case involving the special prosecutor, not just the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, but special prosecutor Robert Mueller. He's pleading guilty to lying to Congress. And the special prosecutor says, hey, the plea deal's off with the president's former campaign manager who's been convicted on multiple felony accounts because he hasn't been collaborating. What is the seriousness, what is the import of what we've learned in the last few days?
Well, from a welter of news that in any other presidency would be, headline making, the Manafort issue comes to the fore. The president, in an interview with the New York Post, dangled a pardon before Manafort. He said, I'm not taking it off the table. Mm-hmm. It's worth pointing out that dangling pardons was one of the articles of impeachment. In Article 1, Number 9 of the Nixon impeachment, the House said, endeavoring to cause prospective defendants and individuals duly convicted to expect favorable treatment for silence, that is an impeachable offense. It was so considered by the House Judiciary Committee in 1974. And the president this week dangled a pardon before someone answering that description.
So this being something about not just what's happening behind the scenes, but happening very much in public view.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's no and that gets to the other issue of, what we heard from Mr. Cohen, that the president had been engaged in a business deal, Trump Tower in Moscow, whilst the campaign was going on, and much longer than he had told. It went up to June 2016. Earlier, he had said it ended at the beginning of the primaries. This is Mr. Cohen. And Trump says that he's lying, but Trump also says, "And if I were doing it, so what?
And
I was a businessman."
And let's play that for listeners, Jack. Good point. You know, yesterday he accused, as you said, Michael Cohen of lying and Trump said the construction project in Russia was just under consideration and that did not violate any rules.
We were thinking about building a building. I guess we had in a form. It was an option. I don't know what you'd call it. I decided ultimately not to do it. There would have been nothing wrong if I did do it. If I did do it, there would have been nothing wrong. That was my business.
Kimberly Atkins, why does it matter beyond Michael Cohen's circumstances? Why does it matter for the president and for us as citizens whether the timing was different than we originally understood it and the way in which the president originally said?
I mean, well, just from a civics point of view, the voting public should know if the president has or a presidential candidate has a significant financial interest in something that will be a part of his agenda when he or she reaches office. And that was a crucial issue leading here. Recall that the president, while he was a candidate and even after he was elected, repeatedly said, I have no dealings with Russia. I'm not doing anything with Russia. I don't have any financial ties. Well, we're seeing that that wasn't true. The full extent of it, I don't think we still know yet. I think we have to keep watching this investigation as it goes forward. But more seriously, if there was a connection between the president through his aides to purposely be reaching out to Russia to try to cut some deals given this financial interest, that's not only unethical and against the ideals of civics, but it is also very potentially illegal. And so that is why watching closely, there's no smoking gun yet on that front, but that's something that we should be watching very closely in the weeks ahead.
And to Jack's point about the question of what happens in public view, all happening at the same time, he was urging much closer ties and collaboration with the Russians and particularly with Vladimir Putin. We're talking about this story and a lot of others. We want you to join the conversation. I'd like my guests, Kathy Gilsonen, Kimberly Atkins, Jack Beatty, stick around. We want you to stick around. The president says he knows, everyone knows he's been working with the Russians. Doesn't matter if he lied, how long he's continuing to do so while running for president. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about this week's top news. You can join the conversation. Mueller is drawing a prosecutorial bead on the White House. What are you taking from what we're learning? And it's not just Trump. The U.S. has supported the Saudis for decades. Is now the time to loosen those ties? If so, why? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Herald, Kathy Gilsonen of the Atlantic, and On Point's own Jack Beatty. Kathy, I want to ask you a little bit about what you've learned, what you think has been set out in the special prosecutor's briefs and documents that have been, you know, emerged in court in terms of our understanding of the president's dealings with Russia and how you sort of overlay that with his approach to Russia from a policy standpoint.
Yeah. Well, so I think people who have been observing Trump's attitude toward Russia ever since the presidential campaign have long been puzzled by his seeming affinity for Vladimir Putin. I mean, you'll recall that Mitt Romney was sort of roundly mocked by liberals for calling Russia the United States' number one geopolitical foe in the year when he ran for presidential election. So it's an unusual – it was always an unusual position for a Republican candidate to take. And then ever since then, we've also seen him sort of demure or avoid blaming Russia for interference in the 2016 presidential election. And so from a policy standpoint, it's his positions have been unorthodox vis-a-vis Russia, although it's not necessarily out of character for him to embrace unorthodox opinions as far as either mainstream Republican foreign policy is concerned or mainstream foreign policy in general is concerned. So then you have that, and then you also have the pattern that we've seen over and over various people in Trump's orbit lying about their connections to Russia or misremembering or leaving certain things off of security clearance forms or things like that. You know, you had Jeff Sessions forget some discussions he had with Sergei Kislyak during his confirmation hearings, Sergei Kislyak then having been the Russian ambassador to the United States. And now you have Cohen also having lied about dealings with Russia. So you put these things together and it just, again, like it's all dots and no smoking connections yet as far as the president's own involvement is concerned. But this is the first time that the Mueller investigation has reached so deeply into the president's own behavior, right? We now know, according to Cohen, that he was discussing Russia directly with the man who is now the president during the campaign, which – and I think it's worth underscoring also what gets lost in this a lot of the time, which is whatever – you know, whatever the Russia issue itself is, which is a big and important one, we are seeing just repeated lying, which makes it extremely difficult to credit whatever denials now come out, right? Like we don't – Trump has lied repeatedly about, for instance, the other Cohen case about payments to Stormy Daniels. So when he comes – it's not necessarily credible anymore when he comes out and calls Cohen a liar. But the problem with a story like this is you have liars sort of on all sides. Cohen – you know, Cohen has lied to Congress. So do we treat him as a credible witness? Who do we really believe here?
And Paul Manafort, who has had his credibility challenged even after reaching a plea agreement by the special prosecutor. NPR and others are reporting that Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman for the president who had many dealings in Ukraine and that part of the world as well, is set to be sentenced on March 5th by a federal judge in his Washington, D.C. case. I'd like to take a couple of calls now. Let's go first to Richmond, Virginia. Matthew, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So I would just like to make a point here and say that I believe that with this investigation, it is very critical that everyone is paying close attention and watching it. I know it's hard to miss because of TV these days, but I hear many people say, yeah, that's politics. It's Trump. What are you going to expect? You know, I don't think they understand that this is going to be written in history books for a long time. And if the president himself is implicated, we're not going to know right now. We're going to have to wait more until the investigation comes to a close, till Mueller has concrete evidence, and then he's going to present it. Many people are expecting us to know everything right now, and Nixon's investigation took years. But this is a serious time in our moment's history, and I really don't want people to downplay it. They need to be paying attention.
Thank you so much for that, Matthew. I appreciate it. Going now to Iowa City, Iowa. Troy, go right ahead.
My question is it against the law for a political campaign to go to the press and ask if they have any dirt on the other candidate? Well, mm-hmm. to say if it's WikiLeaks or if it's the BBC or maybe if the other candidate is actually getting information from an ex-spy from another country and got information from another country, is it illegal for them to do it? It is done every day.
Well, thank you for that, Troy. Let me throw that to one of our guests, Kimberly Atkins. What problem is it? You know, there's been a real debate, God knows, over whether WikiLeaks is a press outfit, whether it's acting in concert with the Russians or other foreign powers, what its agenda is. Nonetheless, what's the problem with the fact that then-candidate Donald Trump threw it open and said, hey, you know, we'd love for you guys to release a bunch of documents on Hillary Clinton. We'd love for you to get those emails. What's the problem there?
Yeah, so I think you touched on it. I mean, WikiLeaks is described, and I think warrant appropriately so, as essentially an arm of Russian propaganda at this point. If foreign folks are interfering with an election, even if they're doing it through a site like WikiLeaks, that is absolutely illegal. If somebody gets information from a foreign person, from a foreign agent's actor, and is using that with the attempt of affecting an election, that's illegal. And if people conspire to do that, then they, too, are taking part in illegal activity. It's very different than saying, you know, to, hey, NPR, if you have some information, please release it, and expecting reporters to go find information. That's different because there's no foreign actor there. And the reasons are important, just like what we talked about. We don't want Russia playing a role in our elections and how our candidates are portrayed or digging up dirt on them. That's about as anti-American as you can get.
The president, as Kathy mentioned earlier, really has been paying attention on this in a lot of ways. His tweets has sort of filled my computer screen. At one point last night, he said, oh, I get it. I'm a very good developer, happily living my life. When I see our country going the wrong direction, to put it mildly, against all odds, I decide to run for president and continue to run my business. Very legal and very cool. Jack Beatty, one of the interesting things in recent days, of course, is all this has played out after the president had submitted written testimony to the special prosecutor in response to questions that had been posed. But he hadn't been questioned about that publicly verbally. He didn't sit down for an interview for that. You and I were talking a little bit about this before the show. And you reminded me a little bit of what the president's former lawyer, John Dowd, had to say on that.
Well, yes. Bob Woodward brings this out. It is that Dowd, his lawyer at the time, had the president go through a kind of practice interview that he could submit to Mueller and show, here's good faith, here's the president, this is a kind of practice session, we're showing you this. And the president, and they talked for a couple of hours. They were interrupted, and then Dowd had a meeting with Mueller, and he said, "Now listen, this is going to get us 1,001 problems," meaning the president will be seeming to lie because he was contradicting himself. But then he said something else about what the president had said. The fact is, I don't want him looking like an idiot, and I'm not going to sit there and let him look like an idiot. And you publish that transcript, that is the dummy interview he did, and people all over the world are going to say he's a, quote, goddamn a dumbbell. Dowd was aware that he had illustrated the president, quote, was clearly disabled. Now, that's a striking statement, and it has some it's sort of the most obvious, in at least the president's way with words, his wayward way with them, is one of the most obvious things about him. And we saw that on display this week in his interview with the Washington Post about global warming, where he just sort of babbled on about the oceans are too small and someone over abroad is dropping stuff into the water. It was just wool gathering. And it raises the question about the president's the limits of the president as any sort of witness, even defending himself. Essentially, Dowd was saying the president is so incoherent he can't defend himself.
We'd like to take a couple calls now. You're lighting up our lines here. From Morrisville, Vermont, Alan is on the air. Go ahead, Alan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm curious to know what your guests and Jack think the Republican Congress and Senate might do with the new Cohen revelations, given that they constantly cited the old testimony of Cohen in their report. I think it was before the Senate committee, I can't remember exactly what, where they pretty much exonerated the president and used that report all the time as there's no, you know, we already looked into that, the Democrats are making a big deal out of nothing. And now I wonder if they have any, or do your guests think they have any responsibility to respond to Cohen's?
Well, let's thank you so much for that question, Alan. I appreciate it. Let's bounce that off Kimberly Atkins. Go ahead quickly on that.
Yeah, so you're referring to the conclusions that were reached by the House Intelligence Committee that was led by Devin Nunes, who can be, I think, accurately described as very close to President Trump, almost acting in a defense capacity. What the difference will be in January is that the Democrats will have control of the House, and we will see Adam Schiff as the chairman of that committee, and you can certainly expect it to be very active in its investigation and by no means relying simply on the report that was put together by Congressman Nunes. You also have to remember that the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is co-chaired by a Democrat and a Republican, Senators Burr and Warner, that investigation is ongoing too, and I think you can also expect it to be looking at all of these developments very carefully and doing their own investigation, too.
I want to quickly take another couple calls. George, you're calling from Plattsburgh, New York, I think, George. What do you think about this?
Yes. You know, I've been watching all this going on for the last 2 years, but like one of your panelists just says, I don't see any smoking gun.
Uh-huh.
It's been a lot of money spent, lots of speculations. I am, as a just middle-class working man, more worried about economy, defense, health in the United States. But collusion with Russia, so far nobody showed me anything that I would believe in it.
Okay, well, George, well, thank you for that. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. So, Kathy Gilsonen, quickly, how seriously is this? A lot of the public, you know, certainly 35%, 38% of the public is with the president all the way. And, you know, there's no smoking gun when it comes to President Trump yet, or is there?
I don't see a smoking gun yet. But on the other hand, that's why we're having an investigation, right? I think the investigation is an indication that we take this meddling in our election extremely seriously. And I think it is worth looking into this. You know, this cuts to the heart of our democracy. And I also think I just want to get back to a point raised by another one of your callers. One of the things that this whole saga has exposed is the many differences between what is illegal on the one hand and what is unethical on the other hand. You have It's illegal to lie to Congress. It's illegal to lie to federal investigators. That's why, you know, that's why Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort and various others affiliated with the Trump campaign are in the trouble that they're in now. On the other hand, we're having a lot of conversations about behavior that's arguably unethical, such as continuing to pursue business deals with Russia that may pose a conflict of interest for a presidential candidate that aren't technically illegal, right? So there are things you could find that aren't specific crimes, but that I think we need to have a real debate in this country about whether we find it acceptable for certain norms that haven't been written into law to be broached. And whether, you know, for example, also, this is something I learned in the Trump administration, that the president is exempt from certain conflict of interest rules that apply to the rest of the government. Is that something that, you know, is the assumption anymore that the president is above all this kind of thing? Does that hold anymore? And what do we need to do as a country if we decide that it doesn't?
I'd like to take a call now.
Go ahead, Jack, please. Yeah,
please.
The issue of the smoking gun. I mean, BuzzFeed, and I'm not saying I agree with it. It's not been substantiated by anyone else, but they have reported that in the Moscow negotiations, Trump offered Putin a $50 million penthouse at the top of his tower in Moscow as a gift. Now, according to someone, a lawyer I just watched on television, that could be a violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That's a felony. That's a real problem. The second issue with all this Russia
stuff is the old reverse emolument play, I guess.
Yes, exactly. And the second problem with all this Russia dealing is political. I went back and looked at the polls. Republican attitudes toward Russia were very, very harsh. In 2015, more than 6 in 10 Republicans said Russia is an unfriendly country. By January 2017, that had completely reversed because Trump had changed Republican ideas on that. My point is that change only happened late in 2016, the polls show. If this had been known, if these negotiations to do business with them, Trump Tower and so on in Moscow, if that were known during the campaign, that would have been an issue. Other candidates would have, in the primaries, would have raised it against him. And Republican voters, who still were feeling by 6 in 10 that Russia was an enemy, they might well have responded. So it was a politically astute move to keep this quiet.
I wanted very briefly to take a call from Williston, Vermont. Marcy, we've got only a little bit of time left, but I wanted to let you have a chance to make your point.
Okay, thanks. So I wonder if there shouldn't be a different process for a president in this country. We're innocent until proven guilty.
Uh-huh.
But we clearly have a president who's guilty of a lot of things, and they just have to be proven. But in the meantime, he's done a lot of damage, and he's been president for almost a year.
Very quickly, so you think he's been guilty of crimes or guilty of bad behavior?
Both.
All right. That's Marcy from Williston, Vermont. Maybe an inversion of our presumption of innocence when it comes to the nation's leaders. She's frustrated. I'm seeing a lot of calls on both sides about this. I appreciate that. We're discussing the week's top headlines. We'll talk about this, but we'll talk about a lot more. We'll talk about what's happening at GM. We'll talk about what's happening in the United States Senate, a little burst of independence, even from the Republican-led Senate when it comes to this White House under duress. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week's top stories. You can join our conversation. What do the GM layoffs mean to you? What do you think of the likely next House Speaker, the former Speaker, Nancy Pelosi? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Herald, Kathy Gilsonen of The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Prosecutors, according to the Associated Press, federal prosecutors say they're mulling new charges for Paul Manafort. That's the former campaign chairman for President Trump. And the prosecutors will detail lying allegations next week. Obviously, this is still in flux. Interestingly, this it seems to be emboldening folks over in the United States Senate, still led by Republicans. They'll have a bigger majority next year when Cindy Hyde-Smith has now been confirmed as she'll continue on as the senator from Mississippi. But the Senate has taken a couple steps and in some ways rebuked the White House. Earlier this week, Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake voted against advancing one of the president's judicial nominees. That's Thomas Farr. Speaking on the Senate floor Wednesday, Flake reiterated his stance that he'll vote against advancing any of President Trump's judicial nominees until protections for special counsel Robert Mueller are voted on in the U.S. Senate.
Some of my colleagues, as there hasn't been any indication that Mr. Mueller will be removed from office. But with the president tweeting on a regular basis, a daily basis, that the special counsel is conflicted, that he is leading so-called 12 angry Democrats, and demeaning and ridiculing him in every way, to be so sanguine about the chances of him being fired is folly for us, I believe.
Now, Kimberly Atkins, Flake, of course, is in the last weeks of his term as an Arizona Republican. He realized he couldn't win re-election. But there's something else going on there as well. Flake was joined by the Republican South Carolina Senator Tim Scott in voting against this nominee, and the Senate rejected it. Republican-led Senate rejected it. What went on with that nomination of Thomas Farr?
Yeah, so there are two things going on here. Thomas Farr is a nominee who has garnered a lot of opposition by the entire Democratic delegation in the Senate, as well as a lot of other groups and folks outside of Washington because of his work on behalf of Republicans in North Carolina in drawing up and defending the districts there, which have been called gerrymandered and has been the subject of a lot of litigation, saying that it's really inappropriate for someone like that to get a federal judgeship. And in this case—
But gerrymandered and particularly restricted in some ways of on racial lines.
Racially gerrymandered, right? Yes. Racially mm-hmm. gerrymandered. And so in this case, that was the basis for Republican Senator Tim Scott to object to that, saying that he had not explained that well enough to his satisfaction faction that he could not support him. So that coupled with this general opposition being put up by Senator Jeff Flake in this case was enough to stop that nomination from moving forward. And then you also have, on the other hand, Jeff Flake, who is basing his opposition not just in this case on this gerrymandering claim, but this in general, his call for legislation protecting the special counsel. Now, there's debate within the Republican caucus as to whether such a bill would be constitutional. Certainly some people oppose this. The issue is a non-starter as far as Senate Leader Mitch McConnell is concerned. He is sticking with his assertion that it's not necessary because the president is not going to fire the special counsel or stop this investigation. But there are a lot of people who disagree with that and point to, among other things, the president's own Twitter feed and his own words constantly berating this investigation as a witch hunt, as a real, and the fact that he's already fired the attorney general in part over this as the fact that there is real concern about the future of this investigation.
Kathy Gilson, there was also a moment this week where with Trump's bipartisan effort, the Senate rebuked the president over the administration's ties to the Saudis and over the question of, as we heard at the top of the hour, of the commissioning of the death of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi, but also about what's happening in Yemen. Can you explain to us a little bit what's going on there, what the Saudi role is and why we're involved in this?
Sure. The Saudis got involved after there's been a civil war ongoing in Yemen for 4 years now, and it started with the takeover of the government by a rebellious group affiliated, backed to degrees that are murky by the Iranians. But it's also fundamentally a local conflict. The Houthi movement overthrew the government. The Saudis stepped in to try to dislodge the Houthis. The United States then somewhat reluctantly under the Obama administration stepped in to help the Saudis with things like aerial refueling support, intelligence coordination, some targeting assistance, that kind of thing. So now what's been happening is that and the war has been a disaster for all concerned. All wars are a disaster, but this one particularly is what the United Nations now calls the world's largest humanitarian crisis. It's all man-made, right?
Civilians are just getting slaughtered there.
Yes, and starving, and one of the world's, maybe the world's biggest cholera outbreak. I mean, it's just a catastrophe, and humanitarian aid is getting blocked by different sides in the conflict. You know, the Houthis themselves have blocked ports, and the Saudis have blocked access for humanitarian aid. And so congressional and public opposition to the United States involvement in this, and in particular the use of U.S. manufactured munitions that have been shown to have killed civilians in this conflict, has been a subject of congressional scrutiny since prior to the assassination of this Saudi journalist. But now what's been happening is that these two issues are getting a little bit conflated somewhat. The Senate has long wanted to, or members of the Senate have long wanted to exercise more oversight over U.S. involvement in this. But now they're able to do it. You know, they have more power politically to do it because of how much the Khashoggi killing has sort of ignited, you know, popular imagination around around what we're doing with the Saudis.
And press coverage.
And press coverage, right. And so, yeah, I mean, it was striking to me, in fact, that you could see, that you could see the Khashoggi killing dominated and it still dominates press coverage in a way that the war in Yemen never has, right? You never got as much prominent front page placement for even Saudi bombings of buses of children, right? But so now that, you know, now that this is in the conversation, the Senate managed to, and it's a bipartisan bill, co-sponsored by Bernie Sanders, who we all know on the left, and Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah. So this has passed a procedural hurdle. It now goes to the floor for the vote. And what it would do is, the senators are now going to debate what U.S. involvement in this war and whether or not they should be supporting it to the extent that they are.
Kathy Gilson, you know, one of the things that strikes me about this is the ways in which the administration is kind of contorting itself not to look too closely at it. You mentioned the Khashoggi thing. One of the things that strikes me, obviously, there's a journalistic element of it because he was a writer for The Washington Post writing about the Saudi regime. But also there's this almost international bestseller thriller version of this, which is that all signs seem to point to the crown prince of Saudi Arabia in the commissioning the killing of Khashoggi, Mohammed bin Salman, called MBS. I'm struck this morning there was a tweet from an ABC News reporter at the G20 who wrote that MBS and Putin just gave one another a bro handshake and are sitting next to one another at the summit. They appear to be laughing uproariously. The Secretary of State Mike Pompeo earlier this week said that there was no direct evidence linking the crown prince to the killing. It seemed to me that the modifier direct was bearing a lot of freight there. And then also the National Security Advisor John Bolton was asked about his decision not to listen to the tape because there's actual tape gotten of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Bolton told reporters in the White House briefing room he doesn't speak Arabic.
You want me to listen to it? What am I going to learn from? I mean, if they were speaking Korean, I wouldn't learn any more from it either.
Interpreter would be able to tell you what's
Then I can read a transcript too.
So you don't think it's important to hear that as a national security advisor?
I'm just trying to make the point that everybody who says, why don't you listen to the tape, unless you speak Arabic, what are you going to get from it?
Kathy Gilson, briefly, how credible is this?
How credible is it that he hasn't listened to the tape? I believe that he has not listened to the tape. I
guess more his incuriosity as a national security advisor and what's going on.
Yeah. So I think there are a couple things going on here. I'll try and make them all brief, though. Sorry. I don't know, because I haven't heard the tape. I don't know that the tape contains information about the crucial question we have right now, which is what was the Crown Prince's involvement? There's a lot of other public reporting, and the CIA is reportedly extremely confident that MBS was involved. And this is partly to do, I don't know what the CIA has, but this is also, I mean, just as a curious consumer of news, you can see that this is partly to do with the structure of the Saudi system. It's very doubtful, in the same way that we know that Putin was almost certainly involved in Russian election meddling. Authoritarian systems work because authoritarians have a lot of control over what's going on. And it's just not terribly plausible that, you know, 15 people very close to the crown prince did this high-profile international incident without the crown prince's knowledge or direction. Having said that, I think also what's happening with the tape specifically and Bolton's little dust-up with the journalist there, I think that's a little bit more about optics. It looks very bad, and it looks very incurious of him not to want to listen to the tape. But it's also true that the tape is in Arabic, and he would get the same amount of information from reading a transcript, which presumably he has done.
Yeah, in some ways, I think you're right, although it might be less the optics than the sounds. I think you're going to hear some blood-curdling things on there that perhaps are just very disturbing to do. It might make it a little tougher to stand by and defend some of these authoritarian allies that we've had. Jack Beatty, you know, the president obviously wants to be able to make his will reality at times. He's lashed out a little bit at GM. I've got a clip here that I want to play of the president talking to the press about his conversation with General Motors Chairman and CEO Mary Barra after the company announced plans to shutter an assembly plant in Ohio. Here, the president says he's pushing her to keep manufacturing in that state.
I don't like it. I believe they'll be opening up something else. And I was very tough. I spoke with her when I heard they were closing. And I said, you know, this country's done a lot for General Motors. You better get back in there soon. That's Ohio. And you better get back in there soon. So we have a lot of pressure on them. You have senators. You have a lot of other people. A lot of pressure.
So Jack Beatty, president's not the only one. Sherrod Brown, a Democratic senator from Ohio, also criticized GM severely for taking tax incentives and then making these job cuts. And at the same time, how appropriate is it for the president to weigh in on industrial policy as directly as he does?
Well, jawboning is not against the law, and President Kennedy did it with the steel companies. I don't fault the president on that. I mean, we have a kind of mixed system in our country. But what I do fault him on is his tariffs. General Motors said that the cost of his tariffs on China and others have exceeded the benefits of their tax cuts that they got from the big tax bill last year. Now, the Koch brothers, of all people, just came out with a study saying exactly that is going to happen to American consumers next year if all of these tariff increases, and the president is threatening to double tariffs on half of Chinese exports, if all of those go into effect by next year, that it'll cost the average consumer $2,400, and the Trump tax cut was worth about $900. So we're facing the tax cuts. I mean, the tariffs are hurt General Motors. It wasn't the reason they made this decision, but it wiped out the capacity they had to make new investments because they were paying these tariffs. And the same thing may happen to American consumers next year, that their tax cut will be wiped out by Trump's tariff increase. And worse, the president tweeted yesterday that GM wouldn't be closing their plants, quote, if tariffs had been placed, quote, on cars coming in. This set off alarm bells in Germany and Japan, which greatly fear the 25% tariff that he's threatened on car imports. And a Washington think tank has said that this would be a huge blow to American consumers, these tariffs on imported cars.
Kim, you're originally from Detroit. When you hear the sound of that layoffs that large from GM, how does it resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, it could be potentially a big problem. I mean, there are plants scheduled to close in Michigan as well. That's a state where Trump won by about 10,000 votes. And that's the heart and soul of the industry there. So that could be a political problem if the voters hold him responsible. I think that's a big question. I think people may hold GM responsible and its approach to this as opposed to the president himself. Certainly his most core supporters like that he was even talking about industry in a way that they didn't see coming from the other side during the election. So it's a big blow, but I think we'll have to wait and see how it affects the president.
I was going to say, it's obviously one with a human toll, a lot of good paying jobs about to be eliminated as well. Kimberly, I want to end with you. We've got a little over a minute left in the sense of talking about the likely next House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi. A lot of people said, oh, she's not going to be able to get there. You know, it turns out she led her party to what, a 40-seat swing in the House of Representatives. It's a pretty big pickup. Talk to us for a moment about Nancy Pelosi and what she seems poised to be able to achieve.
Yeah, you know, she is coming off of a historic gains with the Democratic House caucus. Not only did they pick up roughly around 40 seats, it's also a very diverse caucus, a lot more women, a lot more people of color. You know, somebody from the House said to me a couple weeks ago when Congressman Seth Moulton was trying to mount a challenge to her speakership. If you take a shot at the queen, you best not miss. And she has shown the ability to negotiate and find ways to bring people on board. I don't think she'll have a problem regaining the gavel. And I think she'll be a formidable opponent to President Trump as the head of the Congress, of the Democratic Congress.
Another illustration of the lesson, you can't beat someone with no one. That was Kimberly Atkins, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Herald. Thanks for coming in to Boston today and joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Kathy Gilsonen, Senior Editor of the Atlantic's Global Section. Fantastic to have you today.
Thanks for having me.
and our old friend Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You know where to find us on the Twitters and on Facebook. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.